You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 22nd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Digby from the blog Hullabaloo will be here to look back on the past year, look forward to the next year. It's that time of year, folks, where you catalog your life in some fashion. And we'll do so with the issues of the year past and forward. Also on the program today, Mark Provost from Occupy New Hampshire. Should be interesting. We know what Occupy Iowa is doing for the primaries. See if New Hampshire is up to anything as well. Also on the program today, some good news. Some good news. New EPA mercury rules, only about 30 years in the making. Literally 30 years. 40? 40 some odd years? It's a big deal, according to environmentalists and according to the literally thousands of people's whose lives will be saved each year because of cleaner air. There's going to be some job benefits, too. And speaking of jobs, the unemployment insurance claims are down. And some people think this is a positive sign. Well, let me put it this way. Everyone thinks it's a positive sign. Most people don't think it's that positive of a sign. In other words, if this leads to an announcement, I think it comes at the end of this week, that the economy has added 200,000 jobs plus, that's good, but it would take 8 years of adding 200,000 jobs a month to get us back to what we call peak employment, I guess, which is somewhere around now 4%. But that's good. Ron Paul having some problems today. Because it turns out that video exists, and he did a videotape. The videotape is not that damning, except for it ties him into some racist newsletters he supposedly didn't write, but he supposedly didn't mail, that even though they were in his voice. We'll get to that more with Digby, because I want to talk about the libertarians. And this notion, we've been having some arguments over the past couple of days in the better half of the program about my perspective on voting for Obama as opposed to a Republican, or not seeing the value in having a Republican president for the next 4 years. And let me make it clear, if you email me and try and hold your membership over my head for my opinion on that, I'm going to make something very clear to you. Just as I was saying yesterday that we are overplaying our hand if we think that we can get rid of President Obama in the Democratic Party and won't, you know, usher in a Republican. You, too, are overplaying your hand by holding your membership over my head. That's the most annoying thing you can do. I don't mind the all caps in the email or the half caps in the email. That's fine. I don't care what you call me. That's fine. But if you have not realized that I have a psychological issue with people holding money over my head to get me to do what they want, you have not been listening carefully enough to this program. So we will also talk about the success of the auto bailout. And as we go on, an interesting piece by Rorty Baum, my consul, on the implications. What would happen if we got rid of all the support that our government provides in terms of tax expenditures and student loans and simply replaced it with free, legitimately free, public universities? He did the numbers. Something I've been saying for a long time. It's just that I don't have the intelligence to actually be able to break down the numbers. Seemed quite obvious to me. And a wonderful story about how some activists screwed up an oil industry greenwashing ad campaign, at least for the moment. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Digby.
Say that bowling alley's got big lanes.
Got big lanes. Got big lanes.
Some people say that bowling alleys all look the same.
Look the same. Look the same.
There's not a line that goes here that rhymes with anything.
Anything. Anything.
Had a dream last night, but I forget what it was.
What it was.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a treat for me, as well as you listeners, but even I think maybe more so for me to have the opportunity to talk with the great Digby from the great blog, Digby's blog, .blogspot.com, or Hullabaloo. And she's in the midst of her her annual fundraising drive to support her writing. I hope you will do so, folks. Welcome, Digby.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So during the break, I mentioned, you know, let's talk about Ron Paul, because there are some of our younger compatriots, like Matt in this office, who, you know, really like some of the things that Ron Paul stands for, and I don't blame him, but the broader perspective must be taken here, and Matt, of course, was just aghast when I was talking about him with his headphones on. But let's talk about this. I mean, I want to talk about some of the things that have taken place this year, but, you know, it's a very the libertarian, and by libertarian I mean Ron Paul and Gary Johnson, although I think Gary Johnson's sort of closer in terms of genuine libertarianism. But it's an interesting phenomena, but it's also extremely problematic. But let's take Ron Paul. Well, give me your perspective on it.
Well, I understand why people are attracted to him. For one thing, he just seems different. His entire worldview is unique compared to what they're seeing in certainly in the Republican debates, and the same thing on the Democratic side. So, you know, people who are yearning for different answers or see things are broken, you know, you're naturally attracted to that. And there are also things, you know, both sides, both conservatives and liberals, are always going to find something in a libertarian candidate that they like. I mean, I do. I see, you know, I don't believe in the drug war. I agree with, you know, Ron Paul on 90% of what he believes about foreign policy. I'm definitely attracted to his civil liberty stance, which, you know, comports with mine in most ways. On the conservative side, of course, they see that they're trying to ignore his foreign policy and civil liberty stance.
Right.
And they are extremely attracted to his, what is actually an extremist domestic policy, particularly on economics. So, you know, you can understand why a guy like Ron Paul is attractive. And I think when it comes to young people specifically, you know, on a lot of things that they are personally very concerned with, I mean, particularly on the wars, I think that young people are always a little less sanguine about war, perhaps, than some of us older types who, through our lives, suddenly sort of come to realize it's more of a state of the species than perhaps you believe when you're young. And you know, they're going to be attracted to his stance on the drug war and various other things that are seem a little bit more immediate. And certainly, there is a dearth of idealism in this particular presidential campaign. I don't know where you could put idealism at the moment.
Right.
Certainly, you know, the only person you could pour some kind of hope for something grand and massive would be someone like Ron Paul. And
you know,
so I get it, you know.
It's interesting because I've been noodling around on the Ron Paul website. They don't print any of those newsletters that he sent out.
You're
in the
kidding.
90s. I know that's surprising.
Oh,
about that in a moment. But what's interesting is that, you know, at least when I go to Gary Johnson's website, he comes out and says that his perspective is that we should get rid of Medicare and Social Security and any type of essentially governmental support for individuals, you know, in this respect. Ron Paul, I so far I have not been able to find the words Social Security or Medicare.
Interesting.
On his site. And so it's interesting. And, you know, he's obviously aware of the fact that he has some very, aside from his toxicness in terms of race and other issues, he's aware that just some of his straight up issues are just not going to play with the people that he's attracting. And, you know, so I wonder what sort of game that he's sort of playing. Like, I appreciate the fact that there is someone on the stage at these Republican debates. They don't let Gary Johnson on. They don't let Buddy Romer on. I appreciate that there's a guy who's on the stage saying, you know, we should not be spreading the freedom that we talk about at the end of a gun, and we shouldn't have this empire. And but at the end, what he really becomes is simply another mouthpiece for this sort of, I think it's faux libertarianism, frankly, in some respect, but maybe it's real libertarianism, this conservative, ultra-right wing ideology about government, where government should function only to help the very wealthy accumulate more wealth.
Well, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, it is a, in my mind anyway, I guess you can, everyone has a, can define libertarianism as they want, but for me, the fact that Ron Paul is anti-choice alone reveals the fact that he is not a true libertarian.
Right.
I don't understand how you can believe that property rights are, you know, rule, and yet be anti-choice. So, you know, to me, that's the tip-off. And it also reveals another aspect of Ron Paul that I don't think most people understand, and that is we've seen this week people have dredged up the hymn at the John Birch Society 50th anniversary where he spoke and was feted like a conquering hero, which should set off some alarm bells. But he also has a long-standing association with Christian Reconstructionism, which is a, you know, a kind of an apocalyptic, you know, hyper-religious, you know, far-right philosophy, which holds that, you know, the country will eventually collapse economically. In fact, the world will collapse economically, ushering in this very, very fundamentalist libertarian economic system. It's a very strange thing, but all these guys, you know, that were writing his newsletters, Gary North and Lou Rockwell and, you know, the rest of this crowd, they're all part of it. And in fact, Ron Paul in the last election in 2008 endorsed the Constitution Party candidate. And the Constitution Party, you know, you go and read about this stuff, these guys are all part of this sort of Christian Reconstructionist wing of the far right. Now, I don't know whether or not he is, you know, specifically and explicitly part, you know, a member of this belief or, you know, adherent to this belief system, but clearly he's involved there, and it explains certain oddities about his libertarianism, like right. his anti-choice position. In any case, I'm saying that Ron Paul, I mean, he's an old guy. He's been around for a long time, and he comes out of the far right, we know that. He comes out of the John Birch Society wing, at the very least, we know that. He is responsible for, if perhaps, and I don't believe it for a minute, he was unaware of racist writings that went on for, you know, 25 years. I mean, this isn't just a couple of little notes that somebody dashed off. There's a long record. So that's where he really is. He is a far right guy who has, you know, sort of adopted certain modern libertarian
there's a little repackaging
aspect.
Going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, you know, and, well, and I think he's genuinely, I mean, I'm not going to question his belief in, you know, a non-existent federal government or that, you know, his sort of old-fashioned isolationism, you know, but I'm not going to question that. I assume he truly believes in that stuff. But the fact is that this he doesn't come out of this sort of modern libertarian belief system that the kids, the college kids, are sort of, you know, learning about. I mean, Occupy Wall Street, by the way, is full of libertarian talk and Ron Paul adherents, you know, pouring over his writings and stuff. So, I mean, he's influential in a number of ways, in some dangerous ways when it comes to economics, in my view. But, you know, he's a very odd duck. Gary Johnson is much more of a straight-up modern libertarian.
Well, let me read a quote or two here, okay? Because this stuff, I had never really read any of these newsletters. This one's actually my favorite one, and it's not... It's not racist. Well, I guess it is racist. Sorry. well, it's arguably racist. I've been told not to talk. Now, of course, he didn't write these, according to him, and he didn't read these, though he did make $1 million off them one mm-hmm. year, raising funds. A little bit hard to believe, because, you know, I'd be pretty aware of what the email blasts that were going out, particularly if they were repeated email blasts like this. But I've been told not to talk. This is he, I guess, had some time outside of office, congressional office, when his business was.
Right.
He seems almost like some version of Alex Jones here. I've been told not to talk, but these stooges don't scare me. Threats or no threats. I would probably guess no threats. I've laid bare the coming race war in our big cities. The federal homosexual cover up on AIDS. My training as a physician helps me see through this one.
Mm-hmm.
The Bohemian Grove, perverted pagan playground of the powerful Skull and Bones, the demonic fraternity that includes George Bush, she's talking about George Bush 1, mm-hmm. and leftist Senator John Kerry. He wrote this, we should say, in the 90s during, I think it's during George Bush 1's reign, as it were. Congress's Mr. New Money, the Israeli lobby, which plays Congress like a cheap harmonica. I think that's fairly accurate. And the Soviet-style smart card the Justice Department has in mind for you. This type of stuff is full-on mm-hmm. lunatic fringe stuff. He went on to say that we're constantly told that it's evil to be afraid of black men. It's hardly irrational. Goes on to say Martin Luther King was the world-class philanderer who beat up his paramours and seduced underage girls and boys. Order was only restored in L.A. after the riots when it came time for the blacks to pick up their welfare checks. I mean, it goes on and on like this. Some people suggest that he was just doing this entrepreneurially.
That makes it okay.
Yeah, that he was just basically trying to bring in another group into his libertarian theories.
Hey, he's just making a buck. He's a capitalist, you know.
So here he is with this, and all this stuff is obviously coming out more because, Rick Perry or Newt Gingrich is afraid of him in Iowa, or Mitt Romney's afraid of him in Iowa, whatever it is. But let's talk about the coming election. It's quite clear at this point that at the very least we're not going to have a Republican primary challenge to President Obama. I mean, a Democratic primary challenge to Obama. We may start seeing some independent candidates. Gary Johnson's going to run as a Libertarian. We probably will see one from that, that online entrepreneurial endeavor, which I think is seeking to put a billionaire in office.
Yep.
But you know, what do you say to people who tell you, like, it's better if we don't have if we have a Republican in 2012 so that we can get a really progressive presidential candidate and winner in 2016?
Those people have a lot more faith in, you know, reality rearing its head and, you know, finally teaching people what's right and what's wrong. If only they, you know, if only we hit bottom, will we suddenly realize that everybody should be more liberal? I don't believe that that's how these things work, and I don't think you should take a chance on ever putting in, you know, far-right people into office. I just, you know, that's just my view. I'm with Noam Chomsky, speaking of, you know, I mean, there's a left libertarian guy who, you know, he said, of course you should vote for the lesser of two evils. You get less evil. And at the end of the day, when you're in the ballot box, I think that's what everybody, you know, that's where you end up, is you look it over and decide what is less evil. That's not a great way to do things. It'd be nice if we had perfect candidates, but unfortunately we don't. In the meantime, I do worry in terms of the realistic sort of view of how this election is going to go. Ron Paul, if we're lucky, he's going to make mischief with the Republicans, and I think that's probably a good thing. He seems to be poised to perhaps bring his army of Paulites to the convention and perhaps cause some trouble, and at least bring his agenda into the light and let everybody see what it is before going into the general election. I don't know what this billionaire is going to do. I think they could make trouble too. I think, to my way of thinking, the last thing we need is a billionaire for president of the United States. I think we have plenty of billionaires being well represented in the government. I think we're representing them, smashingly. I think they are doing quite well. So I don't really think we need that.
I don't even have a problem with a billionaire necessarily in office if they have an agenda that is a full-on class traitor.
Franklin Roosevelt, then
exactly.
Sure.
I mean, the problem is you're not going to get that billionaire if there is one out there that would do that at this point, certainly not by that mechanism.
Mm-mm.
And, you know, I wonder if Ron Paul isn't going to cause mischief as we go through the election and essentially for the benefit of Rand.
Yeah.
Right?
I think there's a lot of it makes sense, doesn't it, that he's sort of building a movement around, around RAND 2016. I mean, you know, he's quitting. I mean, Ron is done as a congressman. So we, you know, this is the last we're going to see of him. And I could easily see that. And Rand has a much more mainstream appeal. For one thing, he doesn't have this baggage that his father has with these newsletters and this, you know, John Birch Society connections. Although he certainly, you know, put his foot in it in his Senate campaign when he admitted that he wouldn't have, you know, voted for the Voting Rights Act and didn't believe in civil rights legislation because people shouldn't be forced to not be racist. So, you know, I think the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree on that. But, you know, certainly I think we're looking at some kind of a movement being built around the idea of the next generation there. But, you know, the election on the right is it's fascinating and it's, you know, kind of scary in a way. I mean, you don't want, I mean, I, you know, we're all enjoying it and thinking that, wow, you know, they're so crazy, they can't possibly, you know, they're all falling apart and maybe the right will have to finally regroup and become sane again and everybody will be better off with a sane right wing and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, what if they win? I mean, I keep having this nightmare scenario. Mitt Romney doesn't soothe me in the least. I mean, he is a robot in a suit who I think will do whatever these people want him to do. I see no reason to think that he'll be any more responsible as a president than he would be, you know, than he has been as a candidate.
Well, this is the fallacy of that argument that somehow, you know, Mitt Romney is not going to be any worse than President Obama. And I have been a consistent critic of President Obama's. I actually think his civil liberties record is actually, in some respects, worse than Bush's.
Oh, I agree.
Frankly, because he's actually codified this stuff.
Yes.
And turned it into law, which is the most reprehensible thing you can do.
Right, and put the Democratic Party's, you know, stamp of approval on it,
yep.
Which is hideous. There's no opposition at all now, you know,
yes.
Other than a few fringies like us.
And I think he is a more or less a subsidiary of the banks at this point. But there's no reason to believe that Mitt Romney is going to be any better on any of these things. To the extent that he would be, the whole notion that we're going to have some type of rebound effect and, you know, the next coming of Paul Wellstone is going to be our presidential candidate in 2016 is just makes no sense to me.
Well, it's damn risky, isn't it, at this stage, too?
I would agree.
Stake everything on that sort of thing.
I think we're on the precipice. I mean, I think fortunately, you know, we spoke maybe this time last year, and you made it quite clear that the best that we can hope for is not that we're going to get any new taxes on anyone, or that not that we're going to. It's just that we can save Social Security and Medicare.
Right.
And so far, so good. And going into this election, it's going to be highly unlikely that's going to happen. And my perception is that if President Obama does end up winning in 2012, he is going to be in a radically weakened position relative to either a majority in the House of Democrats or in the Senate or even a minority of Democrats in the House or the Senate.
I hate to say it, but that's sort of my assumption that, you know, I mean, there's a possibility of regaining the House. I see no path to maintaining the Senate. I think it would take a miracle for that to happen. But, you know, he's likely going to be facing a hostile right-wing Congress. And it may be, and not that he isn't already, I mean, you know, but let's just assume that the Senate is no longer cooperative
right.
at all. Picture that Congress. Picture John Boehner's House being validated as having, you know, done the right thing with a majority and a Republican president. Picture what those people are going to do. Paul Ryan is in charge of, you know, budget policy. I mean, that's horrifying. They will do it. I have no doubt. I mean, look what they're doing right now. I mean, they're holding out on, you know, extending unemployment and tax cuts at Christmas time.
Right.
I mean, you know, this is how far they've gone. So, you know, I am not sanguine about the idea that, oh, well, you know, we don't have to worry if they get in, what are, you know, they'll just they'll prove to everyone how bad everything is, and then everything will be all right. You know, this is a very, very dangerous time, and I don't think you take a chance on putting radicals in office. And Mitt Romney will be a radical. I mean, he's not, he doesn't have a center. He has no, I don't think he cares at all.
Right, and about I don't know how you stop. I mean, you know, the argument is, well, you know, President Obama will go along with whatever the Republican-controlled Senate or House wants. But I don't know how you, you know, at least you have some modicum of leverage with President Obama. You have
Let's put it this way. President Obama, if he's reelected, is going to be worried about his legacy. I mean, this is what they all think about. His second terms, you know, are horrible for this, because without, you know, unless he has a vice president that's running to carry on his, you know, his name, and I don't know, I mean, maybe Biden will run, but, you know, presumably he won't. He's a little long in tooth to run.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless, he's going to be concerned about his legacy. And you know, this is where the kind of pressure that liberals can push might have even more leverage than they did in terms of re-election. They, you know, these guys are all concerned about the, you know, the vaunted independent and the swing voters. This is what they care about, you know, and oh, we have to keep the lowest common denominator happy. Legacy is different. That's going to be written by people like us. That's going to be written by historians. It's going to, you know, now the battle will be between you and me and Ezra Klein as to what that legacy
right.
is going to be. But that, I think
that is exactly, I mean, one of the points that I've been making, too, is that the clarity in terms of those distinctions, the ones that you just talked about, the neoliberals, the establishment.
Right.
Left versus the left left.
Yeah.
That is one thing that I think has been quite helpful coming out of the Bush, you know, the Bush years, where we all thought we were one big happy family because
mm-hmm.
we opposed George Bush. We didn't realize that a big part of that family really didn't have a problem with some of the with some of the things that we thought they did.
Yeah.
And that's why I think, you know, under an Obama second term, we're going to see even more movement, you know, in terms of more movement in terms of movements,
right.
in terms of like Occupy Wall Street, in terms of people
right.
On the streets pushing back, because
I think so, too.
Those lines are going to be a lot clearer.
And I think, as I said, I think, you know, when you're dealing with a president and administration that's legacy building instead of running for reelection, I think you're dealing with a different dynamic. And, I, you know, I don't know, does Obama want to be Lyndon Johnson, remembered as Lyndon Johnson?
Mm-hmm.
Or does he want to be remembered as, you know, Franklin Roosevelt? I mean, there is an option there for him, and he will not... His legacy will not be what he wants it to be.
You don't build a legacy on chaining the CPI to Social Security.
Yeah.
That's not the stuff that historians get excited about.
Exactly. And that is not going to... And also the broader thing with this big movement that I agree with you will be out there if Obama is in office. I think it will be much tougher to maintain it if it's a Republican. I think then you get back into more nitty-gritty kind of, you know... traditional politics.
Right.
And, you know, I think that there's an influence there. I mean, you know, people think that money is everything, and it's huge. But ego is huge, too, when you're dealing with politics. Never underestimate the power of ego and the ability to manipulate that in these politicians, because they care about more than money. I mean, Barack Obama will never need money again in his
That's
life,
right.
Neither will his children. So that's not going to be an issue for him. What he cares about is being, you know, I mean, we know. Look at what he, you know, they cut this thing out of the 60 Minutes interview, and the right wing, of course, is turning it into a big, you know, nonsensical scandal. But what he said is interesting. I mean, he sees himself as, you know, one of the top five great presidents, or he sees his accomplishments so far. Well, you know, he's going to have to work pretty hard for that to actually happen, if that's what he wants. It's going to take some more than just, you know, changing the chain CPI and ordering the death of Osama bin Laden.
Exactly.
I mean, that you know, that's not going to carry him there. He's deluded on that. So, you know, presumably there is some leverage to change things without the, you know, without the burden of you know, the being reelected, trying to raise money.
And, frankly, the Democrats around him without the burden of being responsible for his loss.
Exactly.
Can take some of the gloves off, I think,
personally.
Exactly. But,
you know, and in any case, you know, look, you know, I have, again, we're back where we were last year at this time, as you just mentioned. You know, at the very least, you don't want to enable the absolute worst.
Right.
I mean, there's bad and there's worse, and I just don't believe in this sort of nihilistic view that, oh, if we can only... You know, if we can only make things bad enough, we'll get the rapture, and then you know everything will be great. I mean, that's an apocalyptic view that I find unpersuasive, to say the least.
Digby from the blog Hullabaloo, folks, head over to Digby's blog. blogspot.com. We have a link on Majority FM. It is that time of year, folks, and if you enjoy Digby's writing as much as I do. Go over there and put a little jingle jangle in the tip jar.
Aw, thanks, Sam.
Digby, have a great holiday season. I've got to get back to my war on Christmas.
Yeah, I'm late too for that. So
we'll see you next year, Digby.
All righty, thanks a lot, Sam.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Mark Provost from Occupy New Hampshire. Back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Mark Provost from Occupy New Hampshire. How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing pretty good, Sam. I just had to grab a glass of water here. I'm on the run.
I understand. Now, where are you guys? Where are you located? Do you guys have an encampment up there?
No, we haven't had an encampment for what, Paul? 2 months?
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't had an encampment for 2 months. So we actually had a camp for, I think, 5 days, 4 nights. So it wasn't really that long. We realized that most of the country was going to be like that at some point. You know, you didn't have to really be a genius to figure that out. They weren't going to allow them. So we, you know, adopted a new model, and we basically continued to meet every single night. So we had general assemblies every night, and we were convening at the park. And as it got colder, we started moving into a local restaurant and bar, Greg's Place, in on Elm Street in Manchester. And they've been really nice, and we're able to have meetings there of pretty much around 15 people, not the same people, around 15 people every single night. And then on the weekends, we have big events. On Saturdays, we have marches and statewide assemblies or rallies at the park. And on Sundays, we adopted a model where our group goes to all the other towns in New Hampshire. And some of them have little Occupy support groups there, and some of them don't. But that's where we go on Sundays. We go to churches, and it's part of what we call our roaming occupation. We roam around on the Sundays.
Interesting. And so are you guys planning anything for the primaries?
Yeah, we have pretty big plans for the primaries. They're called Occupy the New Hampshire Primary, because I'm sure you're aware, Sam, to say the New Hampshire Primary, first in the nation, you know. So we say Occupy the New Hampshire Primary, first in the nation's history. And it's a 4-day event. We have it organized around 2-hour time slots, and those time slots allow for Occupy groups in New Hampshire, as well as Occupy groups throughout the region, like Wall Street, Providence, Burlington, Vermont, Lowell, Worcester, Boston. They're all going to be participating in this event, as well as community advocacy groups for gay rights, economic justice, against the attacks on workers' rights or budget cuts. We're Veterans for Peace. We're definitely opening it all up.
Fantastic. And you're going to be now you are the guys who mic checked President Obama when he was up there. Is that right?
Yeah, we're definitely the people that mic checked President Obama.
Mic check.
He said we mic checked him on basically like the silencing of democracy and the fact that there was two issues, I think, and sometimes they're kind of tethered so closely you can't see. But it's a question of police brutality. And then there's a separate question, which is just as important, about, First Amendment rights. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, when we were evicted from the park, it was a completely peaceable arrest. The Manchester police only had, like, really glowing words to say about Occupy New Hampshire, how professional we are. And we got in a line to receive summons and then in a line to get arrested. And, there was no violence. There was no, like, real pressure, other than the fact that they're forcing us to go, and then whoever stayed was, handcuffed and put in a car. But, it wasn't a violent arrest by any means. There was no brutality, but brutality has been used. That's one question. And then there's a separate question of First Amendment rights, where even if you're peaceably arrested, why are demonstrators, protesters, and people getting arrested for just expressing their, their First Amendment right? It would seem that's the first law that should be protected. They're citing all kinds of laws. Oh, well, you got to leave because of this. You got to leave because of this. You got to leave because of this. Where's that unequivocal position in the sand that says, wait a minute, this the law of the land, the First Amendment rights, and I think, that doesn't allow you to yell fire in a building, but, Occupy protesters weren't doing anything of the sort. Right. They were citing all kinds of bogus laws.
Right. I mean, there was really no – I don't know of any instances, frankly, where there was a good case made for any type of health or sanitation issues or any issues like that that would in any way impact the community in a negative fashion. You could say, well, we don't like to have a bunch of people here, and I want my neighborhood to be to be calm and this and that, but at one point people have a right to express themselves. And but let me ask you, after my understanding is after
Sam, can you hold that question? Can you ask my buddy? I got my friend Paul Brochu. He'll introduce himself. You can introduce yourself. Let me give the phone to him.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Sam. It was great talking to you.
Thank you, Dave. Mark, sorry.
Hello,
Paul.
Yes. Hi. How are you doing?
Good. How you doing? Now, Paul, were you part of mic checking President Obama?
Yes. Yes. I was one of those people.
Now, did he meet with you guys afterwards? Did I read that?
Well, in the interview, or rather, in the video, when you watch the speech, he makes it look like he was going to meet with us or he was going to talk to us, but no. Pretty much, 5 minutes after he was done his speech, after he did all the shaking hands on his way out, there was no discussion. There was no dialogue.
They did a good job of selling that was going to happen at that point.
Yeah, that's what we thought for a while. We were kind of questioning it when he said it, but I guess everybody just forgot about it, including himself.
Now, give me just a little bit more of just a sense of what we can expect during the primaries. What are you guys going to be hoping to achieve at that point?
I mean, the idea, what we're trying to achieve is raising a lot more awareness on the political process as it exists in America, generally, also globally, but I mean, more specifically, nationally. And there's a number of issues, between, the amount of money in politics, the Citizens United decision, how when it equates corporate personhood with actual individual personhood, and then makes money equal free speech. If you have a lot of money, you've got a lot of speech. If you have no money, you're drowned out. And I mean, that's incredibly un-American. You can't be a free citizen unless you're trying to bilk millions of dollars out of people, and you, if you're just trying to take care of your family, you can't get by anymore.
And so when you guys will be starting within the 4 days before the New Hampshire primary?
Yes, we're going to start on the 6th of January, and we're going right up until the primary. I believe where there's going to be some activities on that day that we'll be part of, along with something that we're going to be doing that's going to be partnered with a few other groups.
Okay. Well, if people want to get more information, where should they go?
They can go to OccupyNH.org. Alternatively, we also have a website that we're setting up right now that it's currently in the early processes. That's OccupyYourMedia.com.
OccupyYourMedia.com, but for now, OccupyNH.org for more information. And if people want to get involved in what you're doing up there during the primaries, obviously not too far. Manchester's just across the border, about an hour, right, of the Massachusetts border?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's more like 35 minutes to the border, an hour all the way to Boston.
There you go. So folks can head up there, Manchester. A wonderful town. I actually I performed comedy there back in the day.
Yeah, it's a nice town. We've actually got a budding comedy movement there in the last couple of years. A lot of open mics are opening up. It's allowing comedians to practice their craft.
Wonderful. All right. Appreciate the work you guys are doing, and thanks for taking the time.
Oh, thank you.
All right, folks, we are going to head into the better half of the program. There I will be talking about these new EPA mercury rules. Good news. An interesting piece by George Monbiot on libertarians. I don't know why I got such a bugaboo with these people. This Rorty Bomb piece on paying for college. And the audio from that that activist punking, what is it called? The Petroleum, the Happiness Institute or something like that. We'll check it out in the better half of the program. Folks, if you can become a member, we need your membership. I know this time of year, people are running around. You're fighting elves and keeping Christian children from celebrating Christmas in public. That's what you, all of you good liberals, should be doing now, of course. Preventing the public display of Christmas cheer. Of course, we have the anti-Christmas Carol Brigade that we're setting up. Have that electromagnetic ray gun that we use. With the hopes of shooting down Santa Claus as he travels across the world to bring people Christmas gifts, on and on. I understand that. So you're busy. But become a Majority Report member, and I promise you, we will send some of your money to the anti-Christmas forces, which are amassing now on the border. You can also support the show by going to justcoffee.coop, buying some coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, organic. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Buy your crap through our Amazon link. Thank you for taking that survey. It was a wonderful success. Call the show 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. Folks, we'll see you tomorrow or in the better half of the program.